Thank you. Neil. Good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the central coast of California. But please hold your calls for the time being because, well, we're going to, of course, have a fascinating guest tonight, one of my favorite guests. Usually we have them for 2 hours, but we're just going to have them for 1 hour tonight. And, of course, Don Scott is a retired teacher who, enjoying his retirement, came across a woman with chronic fatigue syndrome. And she had nobody to help her, so he set out to help her. And in the process, she began to learn about this amazing, amazing disease, which here in the United States involves about 800,000 Americans, give or take some. And, of course, these are people who have become sort of derelicts. Many of them were very successful people in one field or another. Many of them were teachers. Many of them were professional people. Many of them were just average people. And suddenly one day they woke up with a terrible fatigue, and it lasted for days and weeks and months and years. And some of them have really had their whole lives destroyed by this chronic fatigue syndrome. And there's been an organized effort on the part of people within our government to convince doctors and researchers that the disease really doesn't exist. Now, there's the most amazing book I learned about the disease. I learned about the book from Don. It's called Osler's Web. And fortunately, we were able to track them down. We haven't been able to, never been able to get them through regular channels, but one of our listeners helped us to get a supply of the book Osler's Web. And so it is available through Radio Liberty. It's the story of the chronic fatigue syndrome written by Hillary Johnson. And Don told me it was a fascinating book. I will tell you, I got the book. I read it. It reads like a mystery story, only it's a real live story of what I believe is an intentional government cover-up. Because we know that back in 1969, Dr. MacArthur had testified, and he was with the military, and he represented the people who were involved in creating diseases for the government, and he testified before the House Appropriations Committee for the military, that they had the ability to create two diseases. One would be a disease for which there'd be a no immune response. The other was a disease that would create chronic disability. Now, of course, it was about 6 years later when the first AIDS cases appeared, and about that same time, the first cases of chronic fatigue syndrome. But then how could you possibly admit, of course, that you were involved in doing something like that? I mean, why people would lose confidence in the government if they realized that there were wicked people working within our government who would actually involved in creating diseases that would actually kill people. And, of course, as Don Scott has pointed out, that there were a number of something known as the cancer virus study that in 1973 the CIA was involved in, and instructions were given to destroy all of the copies of these reports. Now, if there was nothing to conceal, why would the CIA be so interested in shredding all these reports? There were about 15 of them. Well, I'm going to let Don tell you about this because he's actually accumulated a number of these, and I have several of them myself that's long suppressed by the government because they don't want the American people to know what they've been spending their tax money on and the fact that they have been working to create new diseases. Don, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Well, now, why don't you pick up the story there? Certainly, you got involved with the chronic fatigue syndrome, and, of course, you had talked about Hillary Johnson's book, and you told me that that was one of the greatest books ever written, and after reading it, I was convinced you were right. Why don't you tell the story? We can start out talking about chronic fatigue, and then we can get into, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis and this terrible, terrible disease that incapacitates so many people today and seems to be on the rise all across America and Canada as well. So you pick up the story.
Well, thank you, and I think I'd like to pick it up with one of your comments that CFS, or chronic fatigue syndrome, affects about 800,000 people in America today. Dr. Stan, I do think that figure is very low.
It may very well be.
From my studies of this awful disease, I would say there are at least 2 million victims. And I think I'm being conservative there. But that's just a point to emphasize to your listeners that if anything, we're understating, not dramatically overstating. The other point that I'd like to pick up on is with Osler's Web, that magnificent book by that courageous writer, Hillary Johnson. There's a second book which ranks with Hillary Johnson's Osler's Web, and that's Ed Hooper's book, The River.
Uh-huh.
Now, Hillary was tracking the course of the chronic fatigue syndrome from its start back in the early 80s, where it turned up just as Dr. MacArthur had indicated it would turn up. They were right on time. And Ed Hooper's magnificent book, The River, tracks AIDS. And my gosh, if there's two people in the world that humanity will someday owe a great debt to, one would be Hillary Johnson for her great detective work with chronic fatigue, and the other would be Ed Hooper with his great detective work on AIDS.
Now, why don't you explain to our listeners the basic thesis of The River, and why that is so important, because he goes into why is there so much AIDS in Africa, and why is it in the pattern where it is. So what's the background there?
Yes, well, Ed Hooper started off studying the source and nature of AIDS. And he early on formed a view in which he was mistaken, but that mistake does not mar in any way his great, great research. His mistake was that he thought AIDS was man-made, but was done by accident. He was like a police cop who's sent to investigate a death that everybody says, oh, that guy was accidentally hit by that car, and this is a death by accident. Ed Hooper started off thinking that there was an accident, that what had happened was early polio vaccine researchers like Salk and Sabin and Koprowski and others were trying to develop a vaccine that had been grown on the minced up kidneys of certain monkey species or primate species, including the chimpanzee, and that the chimpanzee kidney that they grew this early vaccine on, an oral polio vaccine that Koprowski was working on, had been contaminated by a simian immune deficiency virus. Now, Ed Hooper tracks AIDS from the very beginning through until about 9 years or 8 or 9 years ago when he finished off his book, and it was published about 3 or 4 years ago, and I have read it 2 or 3 times. And aside from his view that the disease AIDS came into the world by accident, he's a lot like Hamlet, a man so lacking in guile and deceit that doing no evil he will suspect none. But now I'm sure his research is going to lead him into the reality that AIDS was made intentionally in an American laboratory in order to feed it to the millions of people in the third world through the smallpox vaccine program from 1968 through to 1973-74. And he will ultimately come to the realization that this was done intentionally. Now,
he thought, of course, it was in the polio vaccine, but you're suggesting it was in the smallpox vaccine.
Yes, he thought that polio vaccine that had been grown on the kidneys of chimpanzees had been contaminated, and that had been done accidentally. But our research, and thanks to the progress reports of the Special Virus Cancer Program, we've been able to track the reality that there was an intentional plan by a group of high-powered people in the United States, wherein powerful interests of the East Coast multimillionaire banking and industrial controllers, the Rockefellers especially, and the military and certain politicians such as Prescott Bush, the grandfather of present President Bush, and other politicians with their sponsorship of organizations like the CIA, there was a definite planned move to develop the lethal agent you spoke of in your introduction, that's AIDS, and the disabling agent, chronic fatigue syndrome. And let me repeat for those listeners who haven't heard my view on this before, it was necessary to have a disabling agent for the Western civilized countries. You see, AIDS is killing 6,000 black and brown people every day of the year. And the world, frankly, does not give a hoot. I hate to say that. I go to sleep every night tragically affected by this great crime that's been committed against these innocent people. But that is black and brown people, and because they're black, and because they're brown, and because they're over there in Africa and other third world countries, the world just doesn't care.
Well, of course, for our listeners out there who thinks that this is really absurd to say such a thing, I would suggest several sources of information. One is the report on it's on Elizabeth Leagon's website, and it goes into this plan that was put forward by Henry Kissinger about 1973, and it basically was aimed at saying, look, if America is going to be the predominant nation in the world, why, of course, we are going to have to control the population of these other countries. And they name specific countries throughout the world. We can't let their population grow because, after all, they had a lot of people there. They'd become industrialized. Then they'd use their own natural resources, and we wouldn't have them. And
just
they might
like
actually
it.
Threaten us. And that report is up on Elizabeth Leagon's website. Do you recall the name of that report?
Yes, it's called National Security Study Memorandum 200, Number 200.
Right.
NSAM 200. And Henry Kissinger, let me just say this. He is a terrorist who makes Osama bin Laden look like a Sunday school teacher.
But
I don't want to get too far off in that direction.
All right, fine.
What's the link with CFS? Well, as I say, they wanted to develop the AIDS epidemic to clear the world of all these black and brown people who were sitting on great resources, especially in Africa. So they went over there with their smallpox vaccine, which was contaminated with disease agents. And our research in the foundation here, we know what it was. We know who did it. And we can tell you that if anybody wants to ask.
Oh, actually, there was an article front page in the London Times, written, I understand, by the editor of the Times, talking about that. Never appeared in the United States, but it was a front page article. You probably have copies of the article, don't you?
Oh, yes, we do have. And the thing is that they wouldn't publish it in the New York Times or Time Magazine or those literally trashy papers, which are more concerned with propaganda advancing a political, geopolitical agenda than they are telling the truth to the American people or to the world.
And one of the people involved in this had actually gone to the Times to tell them the story, and it appeared one day in the London Times front page and then never to to appear again.
That's right.
Can you imagine the implications of this? This is genocide on a scale that would certainly dwarf the crimes of Hitler, and certain soon will dwarf the crimes of Stalin and Chairman Mao put together. But, of course, we can't let the American people understand the true nature of the evil we face today. And yet, this is all laid out. In fact, there was a man named Robert Strecker who talked about this. I think they broke his will when his brother died under very mysterious circumstances and his medical career was destroyed.
Yes.
Have you ever talked to Strecker?
I know Robert Strecker, yeah. But I don't want to get off the main points that I think your listeners will be interested in hearing. AIDS was to kill people in the third world, because who cares about black and brown people in the third world? The humanity ought to be ashamed of itself. And the same program with different dance, step, and music is going on with Iraq right now, but we won't get into that either. However, CFS, in order to apply the eugenics agenda to the Western civilized so-called countries like Canada, United States, Great Britain, France, Germany, they had to have a disease which would disable particularly women. And that disease was chronic fatigue syndrome, and the agent that causes chronic fatigue syndrome, one of the cofactors is the Mycoplasma fermentans, and of course there is Dr. Xicheng Luo's classic patent in the U.S. government, where he says on page 20 that people with Mycoplasma fermentans infection will be people diagnosed with AIDS or chronic fatigue and other ones, so there's no question about the relationship. However, in Hillary Johnson's magnificent book, she referred on a number of pages to AIDS as being or chronic fatigue as being the mirror image of AIDS. And that started me on my search into AIDS, because if you're going to look at something, don't study it through a mirror. Get right to the original product itself. And that is where the special virus cancer program came in and the progress reports about that. Now, let me outline for your listeners the evolution of the so-called special virus cancer program. And let me conclude this evening by telling you what our latest research indicates, and it's very, very dramatic, and it brings us right up to date. The people right in Washington today that won't return my phone calls because of whatever reason they have, but the special virus program began as a CIA project called MK dash SVLP, and the L stood for lymphadenopathy or leukemia or lymphoma. Those three beginning with L, they're used interchangeably in the various reports, but it was a CIA program to advance the studies and discoveries made by Robert Huebner, who had learned that the mycoplasma, which at that time literally nobody knew anything about, was what was causing the adenoids of sick people to spontaneously degenerate. And they realized that, holy mackerel, if you've got a disease agent, such as a mycoplasma, that will cause a spontaneous degeneration of parts of the human body, wouldn't that make a great biological weapon? So
we're going to have to interrupt you here, because we're going to have to go to a break. And when we get back, of course, you'll get into this whole incredible, incredible story. And of course, some of the work had been done by the Nazi scientists, and now the CIA picked it up. We'll be right back there with Don. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course our guest is certainly Tom Scott, and we're going, Chris, to be talking here about the background of all of these diseases. In fact, for any of our listeners who would like to get some documentation of what we're talking about, we have a fascinating interview with a Dr. Dunnigan, who was a pediatrician in 1969. Now, remember, it was 1969 when Dr. MacArthur was testifying before the House Appropriations Committee. But in 1969, Dr. Day, who would later become the chief medical consultant for Planned Parenthood, Dr. Day, who had been a professor, a neonatologist in Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania, I assume, was talking to a group of young doctors at a medical society meeting. And, of course, he had taught many of these people in the medical school. And when he came in, they thought he was going to talk about the latest developments in neonatology. And instead of that, he is certainly told them, turn off your tape recorders, do not take any notes, and I'm going to tell you what the future holds. And then he set out to lay out this incredible plan, saying, you know, the blacks, why should we be concerned about blacks? I mean, they're obviously inferior people, and they've got Africa, and there's all sorts of wonderful things over there. Why should they have Africa? We're going to come up with diseases designed to kill blacks. And then he went on into, and he described point by point by point what was going to happen. Now, Dr. Dunnigan was sitting there. He was a young doctor just in medical, starting his career as a pediatrician. But he actually took notes of this. And, of course, when he went home, he elaborated on those notes because it was the most incredible story he had ever heard. They were talking about how they were going to actively suppress treatments for cancer. They were going to suppress treatments for all sorts of diseases and use these diseases to transform society and to kill off large numbers of people because, as Dr. Day had said, people are going to have to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. Well, of course, when he took these notes, but how would you dare, you know, first going out in practice, get this information out? So he never told anybody. And it was perhaps almost 30 years later when he ran into a woman who was very interested in this and the pro-life issues that he told her this incredible, incredible story. And she did a series of interviews with him, and I eventually tracked him down and spent a fascinating hour talking to Dr. Dunnigan, where he outlined what he had been told by Dr. Day. Now, Dr. Day went to work for Planned Parenthood, was with him for a period of time, left Planned Parenthood, and died shortly thereafter. But, of course, the story is recorded in our four tapes set on genocide. And, of course, it's very difficult to believe there could be people that wicked. And yet, of course, as you look at the world around you today and you see how AIDS is decimating the population, we've had almost close to 500,000 people die in the United States. The last figure was about 480,000 people, and another almost 900,000 people infected here in the United States. And throughout the world, 32 million people have died, and another 42 million people are infected. And we're not doing anything to stop the disease. We're handing out defective condoms. The only place they've controlled the disease at all is in Uganda, where they've stressed abstinence. We're told you can't do that. My goodness, abstinence never works. Well, the one thing that Rush Limbaugh said, and I agree with totally, is abstinence works 100% of the time, stopping the spread of this terrible, terrible disease. But that, of course, is frowned upon. Fortunately, we have had some effectiveness spreading that message here in the United States. Well, we're going to be back with Don Scott in just a moment right here on Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Don Scott, and so we took a little time there for a break for our listeners up in the Great Northwest, and I didn't want you to miss any of what Don was saying. Don, pick up the story from there.
Yes, okay. Well, as I mentioned, back in 1953, the eugenics crowd learned of Dr. Robert Huebner's discovery of the mycoplasma in the degenerating adenoids. They picked it up as a potential biological weapon of great, great value to them, and they established a MKSVLP CIA program. Now, they did that in utter top secrecy because it was a sub-program within another secret program called MK Naomi. And MK Naomi was not only a CIA 1953, April 1953 project, but it was also within another secret level program called MK Ultra. And over the past 3 or 4 months, we've been linking MK Ultra to MK Naomi and to MK SVLP. And we have made some startling discoveries, some great, great discoveries from our scientific research point of view. And let me just tell you what they are. Now, we don't have a great deal to work on because, as you mentioned at the top of the program, in 1974, Richard Helms, the then director of the CIA, ordered that a number of the previous reports be gathered up and shredded, including Progress Report Number 8 and so on. Now, they did carry on after that date with further reports, and they sanitized them, but even though they are sanitized, there are dramatic proofs that AIDS was created in a laboratory in the United States of America and was spread into the population of the world, and starting in 1968 by the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. And let me just give a summary of these, because although they tried to destroy Progress Report Number 8 and Number 9, and the subsequent reports were sanitized, we have been able, by very careful reading of them and correlating them with other scientific documents of the time, here's what we found. Let's first of all start off with the Special Virus Cancer Program Progress Report Number 9, which I mentioned the last time you and I chatted. On page 39 of that document, the researchers for the United States really make the point that HIV does not cause AIDS. HIV really doesn't exist in the sense that the actual disease agent they're talking about is human T-cell leukemia virus, HTLV, the third species of that virus, and it is an adaptation of a sheep virus called Vizsna. The genomic sequence is almost identical. But anyway, on page 39 of that Special Virus Cancer Program, the sentence occurs that research to elucidate the mechanisms involved in host immunocompetence. In other words, they were focusing on the capacity of the human body to fight off invaders. And immunocompetence is linked, of course, to immune deficiency or incompetence. And they talk then in that other document I mentioned to you, MK Ultra, when Helms set out to destroy all those documents, he pretty near succeeded. He got rid of all the documentation on Naomi, but 59 pages out of the thousands and thousands of pages of MK Ultra survived. And we have those 59 pages. And on page 157 of what survived of MK Ultra, they talk about controlled stress and the endocrine balance in an individual. And they talk about analysis of the neural and endocrine mechanism of stress. Well, over the last 3 or 4 months, we have been able to link very carefully a researcher named Arnold Lippa, L-I-P-P-A, who was working with Ladero, the chemical company, which has links with the biological warfare people. We got all that evidence down.
Oh, Don, and we're going to have to interrupt you because we're going to have to go to the half-hour break, and we'll be right back as soon as we get through that. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our special guest this evening is Don Scott, who lives up in Canada there, and of course he's written several books. We actually carry one of them. What is that? It's called incredible. What is it? The death.
Yes, the extremely unfortunate Skull Valley incident.
The extremely unfortunate Skull Valley incident actually has the quotation from the book.
Somebody wrote a book that we're
quoting Helms actually saying, you know, we've got to get rid of all these records. Why? Well, if there's nothing to conceal, why do they want to conceal it? Because they can't let the American people know the truth. What was that book that quotation comes from?
It was actually from the June 9th, 1969 hearings when Dr. MacArthur of the Pentagon told the congressman that they needed the $10 million to finish up their research into chronic fatigue agent and AIDS agent. He used other language, but it was what he was talking about. And at the end of his report, he spoke about the extremely unfortunate Skull Valley incident,
right,
which was an accident that occurred when they were testing one of their laboratory developments.
And that was, of course, where a lot of sheep or animals died,
yes,
you know, in a macabre experiment. But though I was speaking of the book where Helms actually, somebody actually quotes Helms as saying, you know, we've got to...
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a quotation by Leonard Horowitz, who quotes Helms' testimony, because Helms was called before a House investigating committee after Watergate. Watergate was a great thing in a way because everybody began investigating everybody else, and an awful lot of stuff came out in the wash water. And Helms gave an order to his agent or his deputy director of plans to gather up all documents relating to the illegal use of biologicals to kill third world country citizens.
So they couldn't let the American people know that, because, gee, that isn't very nice. So anyway, they tried to shred them all, but fortunately, they weren't very good at it. And a few of them survived, and Len Horowitz got one of them. And that was number 8, the Special
Wildlife yes,
Project number 8. And then, of course, you were able to get 9, and now you've got, what, 9?
Now we've got, all together, we've got 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, and 15.
Right. Now, but of course, the significant thing in 9 is the fact that they found that the mycoplasm could just really interfere with the metabolism of the cell, so it really couldn't fight off disease.
It was immune suppressant.
Right. All right, so why don't you go ahead and tell the story?
All right, and as I mentioned, our research was able to tie progress report number 9 to Arnold Lippa of Ladero, who I think probably was one of the innocent bystanders. He was one of the genuine researchers who got involved genuinely researching, but his research advanced the cause of those who had the other agenda, the hidden agenda of reducing the population of the world. And he was tied in with a guy by the name of Fritz Dehnhardt, who was doing research on hepatitis B, and who was testing his agent, his hepatitis B pathogen, on chimpanzees in Lindi in the Belgian Congo, where he was a great friend of Hilary Kaprowski of the Wistar Institute, who at that time, it was also in Lindi in Belgian Congo, testing his so-called oral polio vaccine. And this is where Ed Hooper thinks that the accident happened, but we know that it was no accident from the research we've done. Fritz Dehnhardt was developing hepatitis B, and Kaprowski was developing the mycoplasma as a precursor to AIDS, as a cofactor to AIDS. And in number 9, the progress report number 9, it says the potential for such activation. Now that means they were talking about a retrovirus such as a Vizsna virus, which is HTLV-3 in human beings, directed DNA polymerase. Now that's where retroviral RNA takes over the DNA in a human being and makes that cell that the DNA is in manufacture more of the RNA. Has also been noted, they say, in that report. And they say this, which I think today is we have to mention. They say it has also been noted by us to be present in certain pesticides. Now, why do I emphasize pesticides at this point in time? Well, I do it for this reason, West Nile virus. There is a great move throughout much of Canada and the United States to buy and spray pesticides all over North America because of the fear of West Nile virus doing the damage it did last year and possibly getting worse. And in progress report number 9, the researchers say that not only will Vizsla virus alter the RNA-directed DNA, but pesticides will do the same thing. And this in response to West Nile virus. Now, here's the thing about West Nile virus. In 1942, military researcher Joseph Smedell of the Walter Reed Military Hospital in Washington, D.C., was researching West Nile virus, which he and the U.S. government had imported from the Rift Valley area of Africa. They imported it into the United States. It didn't come over in an airplane or a bird or something in 1999 or 2000. It was imported into the United States in 1942 by Joseph Smedell in the Pentagon. And what was Smedell experimenting with? He was trying to find out whether mosquitoes could act as the vector. Could they get mosquitoes in North America to carry the West Nile virus? That in 42. Did they succeed? Undoubtedly, because in 1985, in the Riegel report, which was written by, of course, Senator Riegel of Michigan, he revealed that West Nile virus had been sold to Iraq for use against Iran. The so-called weapons of mass destruction that is creating such an uproar in Britain and the United States was sold to Saddam Hussein by the U.S. government.
You mean to the wicked Saddam Hussein? And sold it to him, we gave him billions and billions and billions of dollars.
And all kinds more. Now, in the special virus cancer program progress report number 9, we find that reference to the fact that pesticides can do the same thing that the mycoplasma can do. That is to say, it can depress the immune system and open the door for the retroviruses.
Well, now, will a sarin gas do the same thing as that, you know?
Probably, but that gets into nerve agents, and it's out of my field, so I don't want to comment.
All right, fine.
Now, here's what I want to do to bring you up to date and your listeners up to date on something else. Many of you will recall that 3 years ago, I was phoned by Dr. Susan Conrath, who told me she was with the United States Senate Government Reform Committee, and she was working with the Veterans Committee, and they were doing work on Gulf War illnesses and so on. And Dr. Susan Conrath said to me, she said two senators were into my office and told me that they heard you had a copy of Progress Report number 8. And I said, yes, I do. And she said, well, my goodness, we've searched the archives of Washington and we can't find it anywhere. And I said, well, no wonder. Richard Helms had them shredded, and we're very lucky to have one. And she said, well, would you do the U.S. Senate a favor? And I said, yes. She said, would you photocopy it and send us a copy? And I said, I would, and I did. Now then, here's the latest thing. A few months ago, our president of the Common Cause Medical Research Foundation in the United States, Shirley Bentley, a wonderful, wonderful lady and a great help in all our research, she found progress report number 15, and she immediately sent it to us. And we've been studying that progress report number 15, and on the fourth paragraph of the last, second last page of progress report number 15, this sentence occurs: a new head of the laboratory operations for the SVCP program, Miss Susan Conrad, or Miss S, as in Susan, Miss S Conrad, was appointed.
So we don't know whether it's the same person or not.
We don't know whether it's the same person. However, Shirley Bentley got me. I tried to track Susan Conrad down, and they told me at her previous number they didn't know where she was, and blah, 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 and I tracked that and tracked it. Shirley managed to get her phone number, so I phoned her on Monday, February 24th, and I got her voicemail. I said, "Dr. Conrath, you phoned me 3 years ago. I sent you progress report number 8. And I said, I've now been studying progress report number 15, and I find the name of an S. Conrath, a Miss S. Conrath, who was appointed head of the laboratory operations. Was that you? Would you phone me and advise?" Well, that was a week ago yesterday. No answer. I phoned again this morning, and again, no answer. Now, what does progress report number 15 contain besides the unusual coincidence of an S. Conrad, which matches the S as in Susan Conrad of the U.S. Senate Review Committee? Well, on page 283 to 284, there are references to the mycoplasma, and that is a very dramatic significance, because that's what Huebner started off with in MKSVLP way back in 1953. And then on page 44 of progress report number 15, it talks about immunoadjuvants, in other words, agents which advance the attempts to modulate the immune system or depress it. And one of the ones they refer to is Brucella abortus. Now, there's where we had started our research, because years ago, when we first read Osler's Web, we took a list of all the symptoms of people with chronic fatigue, and we checked them against the diagnostic criteria in various computer programs, and those symptoms and signs indicated that a person with them had brucellosis. So we started our research with brucellosis, and here, in progress report number 15, on page 44, there's references to the Brucella abortus, and then again, there's a reference on page 72 to the Brucella abortus.
Now, what's the relationship, though, to mycoplasma?
The mycoplasma is very, very important to know that the genetic sequence of Brucella abortus is the same as the genetic sequence of Mycoplasma fermentans.
Now, let me just, for our listeners out there, Don has written a little book on amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and at the end of the book, on page 52 and 53, he actually has a copy of the patent that had been taken out by Dr. Lowe, who is with the Military Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, on, of all things, the Mycoplasma fermentis. And basically, he says that this is a novel pathogenic mycoplasma isolated from patients with acquired immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS, and is detecting antibodies in sera of AIDS patients, patients with AIDS-related complex, or patients dying of diseases and symptoms resembling AIDS. And then he goes on to say that we find this in such diseases as chronic fatigue syndrome, Wegener's disease, sarcoidosis, AIDS, ARC, respiratory distress syndrome, Kubiachi's disease, autoimmune diseases such as collagen, vascular disease, and lupus, and chronic debilitating diseases such as Alzheimer's disease. They find this mycoplasma in all of these, and you'll be pleased to know that the government holds the patent on that. And you might wonder why they would want to patent that. But of course, they say, well, so that we can actually then control it, and we can come up with the various tests to determine whether it's present or not. But the fact that almost all of the AIDS cases and almost all of the people with chronic fatigue, at least according to Dr. Nicholson, about 80% of them will have this mycoplasm. And according to Dr. Lowe, almost all AIDS cases will have a mycoplasm infection as well as these other diseases. It makes you begin wondering what this is about. And of course, Luc Montagnier, who was the man who discovered HIV, said that actually these are co-factors. In other words, it's not one disease at all. It's several diseases. But the American people and the doctors are never told that this is not one disease but a complex of diseases. Would that be a fair statement to make?
Not so much a complex as two co-factors.
Right.
Montagnier says the mycoplasma puts the immune system down. And when those bars are down, it lets in the retroviruses from Vizna, and full-blown AIDS.
Well, he doesn't say Vizna, but that would be, he says that let in the HIV, wasn't that what he said? Or?
Well, no, he didn't call it HIV. He called it lymphadenopathy-associated virus.
All right, fine. So
LAV,
right, okay.
Which is the lymph glands and the adenoids, and that was Huebner's research, too. But you're absolutely right, and the research we have continued to do with progress reports as we've got them. Now, we haven't explored them all totally yet, but believe me, we have a sufficient body of evidence that we trace through the best and most reliable literature, which demonstrates that without a doubt, AIDS was introduced into the world by American government-sponsored and government researchers in order to kill off 6,000 people a day and to disable several thousand others in the so-called civilization.
Now, of course, people don't realize, of course, that it was originally, of course, introduced in the United States, apparently in the hepatitis B vaccine, because they did these studies with hepatitis B vaccine. They had the San Francisco cohort. They recruited a large number of homosexuals. And then, of course, they gave some of them hepatitis B vaccine, and some of them didn't get it. Within a certain number of years, 80% of the people who got the hepatitis B vaccine had AIDS, had HIV disease, HIV infection. Now, why would so many of them get HIV infection when, of course, in the general homosexual population, the incidence was far less than that? Almost 80% of the people in the original San Francisco cohort came down with AIDS, and yet the general population was far less than half of that. And the only logical explanation I can think of is there was something in the vaccine they got. I'm sure you've explored that, haven't you, Don?
Well, yes, that's where Kaprowski, with his research into the AIDS cofactors, was working at the same time and in the same place with Fritz Dehnhardt, who was doing the work on hepatitis B. And they were both using the mycoplasma to put down the immune system and then see what they could introduce with a lowered immune system. Dehnhardt did it with hepatitis B, and Kaprowski did it with the Vizna virus, which is really, as I say, HTLV-3.
Now, of course, are there scientific studies that show that he actually did that?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes, very much so. And it also shows that he was involved when the AIDS broke out among the homosexuals, and it was revealed that they had all lined up, or a lot of them had lined up and taken this free vaccination against hepatitis B, that Dehnhardt was involved in the provision of the vaccine, and that he had been testing his vaccine on chimpanzees in Lindy Camp in Belgian Congo, along with Kaprowski, who was testing the AIDS virus. So they were working on both of them at the same time. And the reason that they decided not only to decimate the black and brown population of the third world, but they would give the same disease to the homosexuals of New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, was based upon their realization that the American public could be told that this is a gay plague. People get it because they are homosexuals who are breaking God's commandments, and they are being punished. And there was a dampening down of research into AIDS for the longest period of time because it was a gay plague. The people didn't have the ability to see, well, look, it's gay plague among the homosexuals of three American cities, but it's certainly not a gay plague among the millions of people in Africa and Brazil and other countries that were given this marvelous smallpox vaccine courtesy of the United States government.
Well, I think the great tragedy is, of course, that some of the homosexuals suspected that this was created actually here in the United States to kill off the homosexuals, and about half of the people today who have died are homosexuals. It's spread into the rest of the community, but it also has a predisposition for blacks. 60% of the new AIDS cases are blacks. And so I believe that there is a genetic specificity for the black population, which is why this new vaccine that Don Francis has put out, VaxGen, really gives the black much better protection than the white. Have you looked at all into the possibility that there is a racial specificity towards this? Because we know they've been working for years to come up with diseases that would hit specific races.
Yes, in Progress Report number 8, there are reports about the ethnic background of people and their susceptibility to certain viral infections. And the point is, of course, that if you take a virus such as Vizsla virus and you somehow manage to mutate it with a gene in the human body that has to do with skin color, then people with skin color will pick up the disease agent away faster than people without it. And there are a number of studies referred to, alluded to, that were obviously part of the thinking of the researchers, so that they could direct the disease agent at certain ethnic groups as opposed to other ethnic groups.
And so that way you can kill your enemies because they'll be a different race. And you say, who would want to think about doing anything like that? Well, I can show you something in the Project for a New America report, Rebuilding America's Defenses, which talks about, my goodness, it's been wonderful. In essence, we're going to be able to come up with these diseases that will target specific ethnic groups. So there really are people of this so devoid of human compassion and concern, of course, that they would want to go along with projects of that sort. We know they were working on it in Africa. They know they were working on them in Israel, diseases that would simply kill off the Arabs. And, of course, here we worked on diseases that would kill off the blacks. As horrible as it may seem, there really is evil in the world.
Well, we have made up an annotated bibliography, several pages of the books and papers that we have. This annotated bibliography, if you start with the first paper, which is a paper by Robert Huebner and his associates about the spontaneous degeneration of adenoids in naval recruits, there you see the beginning of AIDS, believe me. And if you follow the annotated bibliography through all of the documents we have, and we've got, for example, an article written in 1971, 10 years before there was any AIDS, let me emphasize that, written by Dr. Thomas Merrigan of Stanford University, and the title of the document is Viral Infections of Man Associated with, now get this, Acquired Immune Deficiency States. They were writing and studying AIDS long before there was any AIDS because it was being done in an American laboratory.
All right, fine. Now, we don't have much more time. I want to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you and your material. We can't put the price out because this is a non-commercial station, but you can certainly tell them how to get your material and, of course, how to write and contact you.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Dr. Stan, because if they write just to me, Don Scott, never mind the name of the foundation, all that, it just clutters it up. Don Scott, Box 133, Station B, Sudbury, Canada, and the zip code, P as in Peter, 3, E as in Edward, 4, N as in Norman, 5. And you can write to me and ask for our annotated bibliography. We don't put a price on it, but we would like a donation, because when I tell you we're a not-for-profit organization, I say that with utter confidence, because we don't have any resources other than those that we need to for telephones and for research reports and for documentation and all the rest of it. So a donation of, you suit yourself on that, but we will send you our annotated bibliography, and you can start with the first document, and you go through the end, and believe me, when you go through these documents page by page, and especially the most critical ones, such as Kissinger's NSAM 200 and so on, and these special progress reports, if you start at the beginning and go to the end, you too will realize that the government of the United States is murdering 6,000 people a day and disabling probably an equivalent number. And
well, of course, these are certain evil people. This is not the whole government. It's certainly a small clique of very wicked people who are working behind the scenes without the knowledge of the majority of people, who would be horrified if they really understood what was going on.
Absolutely. And my very, very dear friend, Shirley Bentley, and her husband, Don, and the other fine, fine people in the United States who are working in our Common Cause Medical Research Foundation, these are marvelous people, and they do such marvelous research, and they're so very helpful, and they're able to provide us with all kinds of dramatic documentation. Admittedly, some comes in to us anonymously. We will get a plain paper envelope, and in it will be a most dramatic document.
Yeah,
we don't know where it came from, but when...
These are people who are really afraid for their jobs and sometimes afraid for their lives, and I've had the same thing happen. Don, we're out of time. It's been fascinating talking to you. Next time, we've got to get you on for a couple of hours. And we've just begun to scratch the surface here with Don and his work. And again, that address is Don Scott, Box 133, Station B, Sudbury, Sudbury, Canada, P3E4N5. And thanks very much for being with us. God bless you. And I wish we could go on for another hour, but unfortunately we don't have time tonight.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan, and God bless you and all of humanity. I appreciate the opportunity of chatting with you and your listeners.
Good night. God bless. Okay, bye-bye. Well, I hope our listeners appreciate Don. The fascinating amount of information. I still think HIV is there, but of course the mycoplasma plays an important part in this disease, and they're not talking about that. Why? Well, of course, we just can't seem to come up with a cure for HIV, and yet, of course, almost all these people have a mycoplasma infection, which makes them susceptible to this. Well, there's so much here that we haven't even begun to touch on, but we hope that you'll be curious, you'll want to get more information. Go to my website, radioliberty.com, pull down our population control agenda monograph. It'll give you an introduction to this whole incredible story. That's the radioliberty.com. Pray for America. Pray for our boys who are going to go into battle very, very soon. Pray for our leaders, for our ministry. Certainly pray for revival in America. Because if the American people don't turn back to God, God is going to turn his back on America forever. And remember, if you'd like to get in touch with us, our number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV War. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening, Dr. Stan, here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because right now we have with us on the line from up in the Sacramento area, Randy Thomason. Hi, Randy.
Dr. Stan, hello there.
Tell us what's going on up there.
Oh, well, you know, it's the old stuff about taxes.
Right.
All the time.
Well, I think that one of the two things that we can be sure of, one is death and the other is taxes, and they may be able to do away with death but never taxes.
Well, and Christ is Lord, and there we go.
All right, fine. Well, now what's actually happening up there? Are the Republicans holding strong? I understand that the governor actually vetoed the tax levy or whatever the Democrats are trying to put in illegally.
Well, there was the car tax idea, which was attached to an original proposal led by Assembly Speaker Herb Wesson and his fellow Democrats. But Gray Davis, who had announced that he would now oppose the car tax, is now open to it again. And so that's why it's very important that the effort that Tom McClintock is leading succeed, because if the Democrats are able to put anything through, it would be a car tax. It would be something that the courts could find illegal eventually, because additional revenues cannot really be raised except by a two-thirds majority, not a simple majority as the Democrats would like to do. But if the car tax were raised, if it was doubled or tripled, then there would be an instant referendum, which would be to reverse the legislature's action, and there would be about a 90-day cycle to do so. So those counter-efforts are already being prepared.
Now, I understand that the governor wants to raise the income tax, but only on the wealthy. He wants to get more money out of the Indians, some sort of a gimmick there that get money out of them. He wants a 1% sales tax. Can he get any of these things through without the support of the Republicans?
He can't raise taxes directly without the Republicans being co-opted in the deal. And so that's why the car tax is the standout, that the Democrats could try to raise that and think they can raise it with a simple majority. But, you know, it's really incumbent upon the Democrats. They're trying to do what they're doing, but it's also incumbent upon the Republicans to stand firm against tax increases, additional fees, or assessments. You know, we're taxed through the smithereens already. And that's why a lot of people have emailed our organization to say, hey, they're considering moving out of the state. They are having a much harder time paying their bills. And that's why we're encouraging people to visit our website, if you like, SaveCalifornia.com. At SaveCalifornia.com, you can send an email to all the state legislators and the governor saying no new taxes or fees. You can also get the phone numbers to call them. And Dr. Stan, I'll tell you, the perversity agenda is really, really going hard up here, and I want to talk about that briefly, if that's all right.
All right, fine. There's one other thing I want to ask you. What happened to the recall? Have they ever been able to get the people together, or are they going to divide and conquer? There were three people, or three various groups, who are all coming up with a recall for the governor. I suspect that he probably is behind at least one of these groups, realizing if he can get enough people working against one another, he can, of course, stay in office.
It does get a little confusing. I've talked to some people behind the scenes saying, okay, what can be done to get together the Ted Costa, peoplesadvocate.org, which serve the recall papers to Davis, get them together with Howard Kalugian of recallgraydavis.com website. And I don't know if they're going to get together soon, but they may get together later. I think it's actually a battle of the consultants. So I hope the egos come together, and no one says, well, I just want to be better than you or whatever.
No, and I thought that Senator Mountjoy's son, Dennis Mountjoy, was part of one of those groups.
Well, yeah, Dennis Mountjoy, standing a Christian state legislator, he's standing up for a lot of wonderful things, and he had signed the recall papers that were also signed by Ted Costa of peoplesadvocate.org, Sean Steele, the former state Republican Party chair, and also Melanie Morgan, who's a talk show host on the radio.
Now, what about the new head of the Republican Party? Is he going to join this, or is he going to simply go along with Gray Davis?
Duff Sunhine, a moderate Republican who does not want to talk about issues, and I think that's a wrong direction for the Republican Party, he has said he would sign the recall petition. He said that he doesn't know how much money would go into it. Of course, the goal is to raise about $2 million.
In other words, the new head of the Republican Party really doesn't want to recall Gray Davis, does he?
I can't speak for him. He said that he would sign it. He thinks Gray Davis deserves to be recalled, but how much actual work he'll put into it is yet to be seen. Dr. Stan, probably in a couple days we'll be seeing the recall petition get out there. And we'll see if nonprofits like Brad Dacus's nonprofit, our nonprofit, and others are able to circulate petitions or not. We're not sure yet, but it's going to be a big flood of people who want to sign that petition because they want Gray Davis gone.
All right, fine. Well, I think it's very strange. The head of the Republican Party is not leading the charge, but maybe there isn't an awful lot of difference between the current Republican Party leadership and the current Democrat Party leadership. Anyway, we have some good Republican legislators up there. Thank goodness for them. They are holding the line. Okay, tell us about the perversity factors that, and, of course, what's happening there.
Well, religious freedom, parental rights, the Boy Scouts, the institution of marriage, all these things are at stake in light of about six homosexual and transsexual agenda bills. Our organization, Campaign for California Families, held a news conference this week at the Capitol and got some radio and newspaper coverage. The LA Times is going to be doing a story as well. And they're interested in these bills, and I just want to list them briefly. AB 205 is homosexual marriage. It's inserting virtually all the rights of marriage into a domestic partnership package and would recognize civil unions, Vermont-style homosexual marriage from out of state. Dr. Stan, you know what this is. It's a reversal of the people's vote from 3 years ago. It's a very bad bill, and it's catching some heat. There's another terrible bill, AB 196, which would allow $150,000 fines without a trial against business owners and property owners, including Bible bookstore owners, including non-religious nonprofit groups like the Boy Scouts. Why? If they did not hire a transsexual job applicant. I mean, there's no religious exemption. It's a terrible bill, similar to AB 17, which would tell state contractors, private businesses, and nonprofit organizations that supply goods or services to the state. That bill, AB 17, would actually tell them, you've got to supply homosexual marriage rights and benefits and pay for it in your company, or else you're out the door as a state contractor. You can't be one unless you pay for homosexual marriage benefits. These are just three examples of six bills that are very bad. And there, I'd like to basically give an action alert to your listeners, if I could. I'd like to ask you to visit SaveCalifornia.com, where you can send an email against all these bad bills. Your one email will go to every state legislator who has email and Governor Gray Davis, and they'll get the message. You can also visit SaveCalifornia.com for your legislators' phone numbers, and just call and email. And Dr. Stan, we already have some good news on this. This doesn't mean give up the fight, but it means that the fight should increase. The two of the three bills I mentioned, the bills affecting marriage with the vote of the people and marriage with the state contractors, those two homosexual marriage bills have been delayed in committee. They were to be heard earlier today, and those bills have been delayed for a hearing until April 1st. And that means, I believe, that there's been a lot of heat already, and those bills are shown to be hot potatoes, even in the eyes of Gray Davis. And again, we've got to get ourselves going hard on these bills, and I'm praying for their defeat, because especially in this recall election year, let's ask God to put his fear into Gray Davis's heart that these bills would be vetoed if they should ever reach his desk.
And I think the other interesting thing is that they tried to get legislation through to shut you off so that you couldn't offer this service. In other words, you go to our website, send an email, and you can send one email to all the members of the legislature and the governor. They didn't like that, did they?
No, they didn't.
They didn't want to hear from the people.
The state blocked our emails last month, or actually in late January. And we've got the smoking gun. We've got the evidence with the help of the United States Justice Foundation and Gary Creep and his fine attorneys there. We filed a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit, and we're actually filing for a federal injunction at the end of this week. We hope to have a restraining order from a federal judge by early next week. We need the state bureaucrats to remember that this is government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And lastly, I know Brad Dacus probably will want to comment on this too, but the Pledge of Allegiance, I mean, we need the words under God in there. We need children to be hearing the name of God so that they have some sense of accountability that someone is watching them, even if no one else is. I'm hopeful that that case could go to the U.S. Supreme Court and will be dealt with, because when our founding fathers said no establishment of a religion, they meant no official denomination. They didn't want a church of the United States of America like the Church of England, where the Queen is the head of the church, but surely they called this a Christian nation, and surely they would not think that God should be exterminated from public life, including public schools. It's just ridiculous, and that's why you've got some crazy judges in there. That's why these federal judges matter so much.
Well, I think that, Christy, I'm sure that God is not going to put up with this much longer. I'm sure he is going to intervene, and I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice cannot sleep forever. I think that we have people there who are a society of homosexuals, by homosexuals, and for homosexuals, and of course there's no incidents in all history where society has accepted this this really rejection of God's plan for humanity, and that society has survived.
Yeah,
and I think it's about time people realize that when they elect a homosexual, they're not electing a representative. They're electing somebody who is going to pursue a homosexual agenda. And, of course, God is going to bring judgment on those communities, I really fear.
Yeah, so if you want to stand up for this, we want to quadruple the pro-family movement in California. Please visit our website today, savecalifornia.com, and let's take the pain that we see in politics and let's use it as a goad to our side so that we do our part, whether it's even sending one email to every state legislator and the governor or making the phone call. Do something, and then you'll be shining a light instead of just watching the darkness.
All right, fine. And do you want to put out a telephone number?
Sure. Our phone number is 916-443-1410. If you call tonight, just say you'd like a free newsletter sent to you that you heard us on Dr. Stan's radio show. Again, the phone number is 916-443-1410. We'd love to send you a free newsletter to encourage you that there's other people out there who think like you do.
All right. God bless you. Thanks so much, Randy.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Let's go to Brad Dacus. Hi, Brad. How are you doing? Brad from the Pacific Justice Foundation. Tell us what's going on besides the fact that the Ninth Circuit Court refused to hear that case. In other words, the three-judge panel that said you got to take under God out of the Pledge of Allegiance, that a decision still stands.
Right, it does. And I guess Randy beat me to the punch on that.
Well, he said he wanted to hear, he wanted you to tell what he's thinking.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, anyway, the significance of that from a legal...
Go ahead. Oh, we hit the wrong button and we lost. I'm going to ask you to go ahead and get Brad back on here. And we were getting rid of Randy and we got rid of Brad as well. So, But basically, what has happened is the Ninth Circuit Court, having heard the case put forward by a father who was representing his daughter, who is a Christian, who didn't wasn't offended at all by this, but of course they're not interested in right and wrong. This man, of course, hated God, and this is a means of getting this mention of God out of the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, you have to understand there is a conspiracy against God. This is really what it's all about. And when you understand that, everything makes sense. For instance, God created mankind in his own image, and God values human life. And so the devil wants to kill as many people as we can. That's what so many wars are about. Well, right now, Brad, I'm sorry I cut you off accidentally. Why don't you go ahead and pick, what are your thoughts? What's going to happen? Is this case going to be appealed to the Supreme Court?
Yes, it will. The school district has filed an appeal with to the United States Supreme Court, a petition, and with that, the Ninth Circuit has decided to once again stay its decision, which means, in layman's talk, while we're waiting for the Supreme Court to hear the case, boys and girls can still say the Pledge of Allegiance in public school. So they're not going to enforce it, and it will be at the Pacific Justice Institute are really glad about that, because of course we're the ones who actually fight in the courts. And we're in the process of actually preparing a very important brief on that, amicus brief, to be filed with the Supreme Court on behalf of the parents who have kids in public schools in the Ninth Circuit, including all of California.
Now, for our listeners, an amicus brief means that Brad is not necessarily involved in the case, other than the amicus friends of the court opinion will be heard by the justices along with the arguments put forward by the school board's attorneys. Would that be correct?
Right. That's absolutely correct. That's what an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, is. But they're so important because it's important for the court to hear all the arguments that can be made. And, of course, we being here in the state of California, think that it's very important to stand up for the rights of our students to be able to say the Pledge of Allegiance in our public schools. It's just so basic. The other issue I guess I wanted to go ahead and bring up and address from this last go-around was dealing with that school district, Yorba Linda Placentia Unified School District's decision to not allow the Bible Club on campus. We went ahead and challenged them. And what they've decided to do, their response, has been to keep out all clubs off campus that are non-curriculum. So instead of accommodating the one Bible club, they're going to keep all the non-curriculum related clubs off campus. They think they can get away with it. We've sent them since another demand letter stating that that's still not a valid alternative. And so we're waiting for that response. But it looks like we're going to have to be filing another lawsuit. And it's going to be against that school district on behalf of the Christian club.
But, of course, this is simply another example of anti-Christian bigotry.
Right.
And so rather than let the Christians on the campus, they're going to ban everybody. In other words, intense hatred of Christianity, and they're going to, of course, take it out on everybody. You would think that the people there in that school district would be incensed.
You're absolutely right. You would think so. But all it takes is just a few to be able to challenge this injustice, and we are glad that there are some parents and some students and some pastors that do take it very seriously, and we're working with them very aggressively to try to get it resolved without litigation. But it doesn't look like it looks like we're going to have to file a lawsuit and on behalf of those students.
All right, fine. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us, other than, of course, your website and telephone number?
Oh, thank you, Dr. Stanley. I appreciate that. Our website is pacificjustice.org. If you want to keep up with our cases and sign up to keep up with our litigation and things that we're doing in the courts, it's pacificjustice.org. Or if we can assist you with our free legal assistance, free legal counsel, representation, we do all our work without charge. Also, our toll-free number is 888-305. It's a toll-free number, 888-305-9129, 305-9129.
God bless you. Thanks very much, Brad.
Thank you, Dr. Stanley.
Bye-bye.
I always appreciate it.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Brad Dagus from the Pacific Justice Foundation, and now we'll get to our very good friend, Barrett Schoes. We're going to be talking about her essays on the Office of Homeland Security, or as we say, the Homeland Insecurity, because, of course, the whole purpose behind this is not to fight terrorism. It is to set up a police state in what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave, because, of course, if you read the USA Patriot Act, this legislation that was put through 46 days after the September 11th attack that contained all of these issues, all of these things that Bill Clinton, even the wicked Bill Clinton, could not get through. Of course, George Bush did get through. And, of course, this gives really dictatorial power to the government. It does away and trashes the Fourth Amendment and so many of our other basic rights. Why would George Bush administration push through Bill Clinton's administration, Clinton's program that Bill Clinton couldn't get through? Well, there are lots of unanswered questions out there, and I think the questions that everybody who loves freedom and loves this country has to ask, and ask very seriously. And then now, of course, this Office of Homeland Security and this program of total information awareness of this whole, and we'll point extra. Apparently, Congress has said you can't do this, but you have to know that this is what they want. They want to monitor every individual. They want their video cameras every place. They want ID cards. They want to be able to tap your telephone and listen to what you're saying, because they really want to get the people who are opposed to what's going on. And, of course, all of this really is going to come down to identifying those people, the Christians who really believe and hold their faith dear, and, of course, who oppose what's going on. And we've already seen in the government's own publications that this was the joint task force, anti-terrorism task force, in the Phoenix, Arizona. And they told you how to identify terrorists. They were people, well, they were people who talked about the Constitution and would use it against the government and the United Nations. What do you mean, use it against the government and the United Nations? The government is founded on the Constitution, isn't it? No, it isn't. There are people who don't believe in the Constitution because it was a document crafted by people who believe that our freedom came from God. And there is an anti-Christian bias at the upper echelons of our society today. And, of course, this is really what it's all about. They are going to target Christians. There is no question at all. If you'd like to see that that FBI flyer, it's up on my webpage. Nobody's ever been punished for it. Friends of ours have actually called the police officers and the departments that our telephone numbers are there, and they agree that they actually joined together with the FBI. They were so intimidated by them, they actually became part of this whole program. And you can tell who a terrorist is because they talk about the Constitution, or they have believe in a sort of a doomsday scenario. They probably believe that you know, that the Lord is coming again one of these days, and these might be the end times. That would automatically qualify you as a terrorist. And you say that's far-fetched? No, I've actually been contacted by the FBI and asked if I believe that these were the latter days. So with that in the background, Barrett Schoss, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. It's good to be back again.
Okay, fine. Well, why don't you tell us your take on the Office of Homeland Security and why we should perhaps be more concerned about that than about terrorism?
Well, let's first look at some of the statements that were made concerning this transformation. For example, if you go to the website of FEMA Region 6, we can read on that website that the president has proposed the most, and this is all a quotation now, the most significant transformation of the U.S. government in over a half a century by consolidating the current confusing patchwork of government activities into a single entity, the Department of Homeland Security. And then we can go to President Bush's own statement where he was celebrating the passage of the Homeland Security back in last November, and he said, the United States Congress has taken an historic and bold step forward, and he says, he talks about this, the most, quote, the most extensive reorganization of the federal government since the 1940s.
Well, because what it does, it takes away the checks and balances of the legislature. It sets up a situation where you can't have whistleblowers. It restricts our freedom of information and violates the laws of our land. But what it does is gives literally dictatorial power to the president. It strengthens the executive and weakens concept of checks of the legislature and our duly elected representative. One man is the all-powerful ruler of America under this.
Right. Right, and it also takes away the 10th Amendment to our Constitution, where we are told that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, though prohibited to it by the states, are reserved for the states. Nothing is reserved for the states under this new system, because the system that they are organizing is going to be a vast national, international system of partnerships and networks where everybody is working together. We see it already with the whole grant giving powers of the federal government. They got, let me pay more taxes to the federal government, and then they give it back to the states with ties to compliance. Everybody has to do what the federal government says, because otherwise we won't get the funding. And when we hear about the standards and assessment and accountability, what we're talking about is every state, every community, every organization that's working with the government, including faith-based ones, become accountable to the government to follow their rules and their policies. It's a total transformation. Now, we saw this coming with former President Clinton's executive order on federalism, because he had redefined federalism. He was talking he drafted a second executive order, because the first one was the only executive order I know of that Congress actually opposed, and there was a lot of controversy. So President Clinton wrote a second one, but it was no better than the first one. And what he says is that if the states are not happy with what the federal government wants to do, the federal government doesn't have to submit or face any kind of restriction. What they do is talk about it. They have to dialogue to consensus. The problem, of course, is that when you negotiate or dialogue with the federal government, again, the one who holds the purse strings, who has the money, who defines the terms, will win. They are the stronger partner. So right now, there is no, under this whole new system, there's no state sovereignty as we've had in the past and as we believed was vital to this great republic.
And of course, basically what it does, it brings the local police and the state highway patrol or whatever it be under federal control.
Right.
It gives the federal government police power at the local level, the last thing our founding fathers ever wanted.
Right.
I mean, the biggest mistake we ever made was creating a Federal Bureau of Investigation and a Central Intelligence Agency, and now it gives the federal government control over our local police when that knock comes at the door. You know, you say, well, these things could never happen in America. The only people they're arresting now, are American citizens who are terrorists like the Dean and this other fellow. But once they've established the precedent that they have no constitutional rights, then, of course, they've established the concept that they can pick you up or anybody they want to. All they have to do is say that you may be a terrorist. And, of course, remember, the definition of terrorism has changed. It has nothing to do with Islamic terrorism. It has to do with people who object to what's going on, who object to the New World Order, the New World Authoritarian Fascist Society.
Right. Now, if we go to the Homeland Security Act, we can see a precise definition of terrorism, which is much more actually precise and clear than many other definitions. For example, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, for example, is broader. But in the Homeland Security, it ties various attitudes to a criminal act. But it implies
attitudes?
Well, it says, It appears to be in, let me read through it, because I think we need to clarify that definition. Terrorism is any activity that involves an act that is dangerous to human life or potentially destructive to critical infrastructure or key resources. That doesn't apply to us. Is the violation of the criminal laws of the United States. That wouldn't be applied to us. And then it says B, appears to be intended, in other words, the motive, to intimidate or coerce the civilian population, to influence a policy of the government by intimidation, or to affect the conduct of the government by mass destruction. Now, that sounds like it might rule out just conservatives and those who are concerned about the Constitution. But the problem is that the emphasis now is on prevention, and the word prevention comes up continually on the White House.
We're
going
to be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Barrett Shows. Barrett, just pick up the story there. You're talking about there seem to be concerned about attitudes, people's attitude towards what's going on. Why don't you sort of elaborate there?
Okay, if you go to the White House, and I want everyone who's listening to know that if you come to our website, we have an article titled Homeland Security and the Transformation of America. And it will cover much more, many more details than we will have time to discuss. And everything that I have and I'm saying now will be documented in that article. And so if we, for example, go to the White House and look under the a paper that is prepared as a PDF file, the National Strategy on Homeland Security, and it says, the attacks of September 11 have redefined the mission of federal, state, and local enforcement authorities. Law enforcement agencies should now be assigned priority to preventing terrorist activity within the United States. In other words, not so much on catching or punishing criminals, but preventing terrorism from taking place, which means you profile the public and you begin to see who is at risk, who might have the attitudes and the intentions of doing something that would violate what they their policies. And here in the definition for terrorism, what we see is the clue is those who would intimidate or coerce a civilian population. What does it mean to intimidate? Influence a policy of government. In other words, those who might be opposed to the government's policies of doing more and more, becoming more entwined with UN policies and treaties and so on. And as soon as you begin to look at how to prevent those people or to find those people so you can watch them and keep them from doing it, you know, then you have the kind of outline or profiling that we see in the joint task forces that brochure that you were mentioning. And you said you had that on your website.
We actually have the Phoenix, Arizona FBI Joint Task Force folder up there. We suggest people go up and get it. And if you want a copy of it, of course, you can always call us. We'll get you a better one. But it's up there. And you have to understand that if you believe in the Constitution and you talk about the Constitution and you want to use that against this misuse of government power, you, by their definition, are a terrorist, and you will be reported to the appropriate authorities. And you say, that's crazy. Well, you got to read this thing, and it's accurate, and nothing was ever done to punish the FBI that people who put it out. These are just trial balloons to see how far they can go, and they can go pretty far because the American people are so complacent and so trusting, and we're rallying behind our government. After all, they're going to protect us from the terrorists, but are they really going to protect us from the terrorists? I mean, the major financiers of this international terrorist movement, Al-Qaeda, and this whole radical Islamic movement is Saudi Arabia, and the government's doing everything they can to block lawsuits to bring those facts out. So if we're protecting the people who are financing terrorism, what does that tell you about the real motive of the people who supposedly are fighting it? Maybe, of course, they're using it more than fighting it. So anyway, there's so many things in this Office of Homeland Security legislation we need to be concerned about. And, of course, this is not being brought out. Our attention is actually focused on the war overseas. And while we're watching this unfolding drama, and, of course, we're being terrorized as they raise the level from yellow to orange and, you know, have everybody buying duct tape and plastic. And in fact, I have one article where they said, you know, you want to have salt, towels, and running shoes. Now, how many of you out there are going to be in a position to run, and where are you going to run to with your running shoes? I'm sure they're out there just laughing and chortling at how stupid the American people are as they manipulate their emotions, and some people on the verge of hysteria, living in constant fear. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you have no idea what fear is, because once your freedom is lost, you really have something to fear. And they're using terrorism as a big vehicle of justifying expansion of government control over our lives. If they were really interested in stopping terrorism, they would have closed our borders. They've done everything they could to block it, just as they've done everything they could to block the bringing of drugs and other things into this country. Or they've certainly done everything they could to block capturing Osama bin Laden. And I know people who have known where he was and went to the government, and the government wasn't interested in where Osama bin Laden was. We need him out there. We've got to have that enemy to rally the people against. And the wicked Osama bin Laden, now, of course, it's the wicked Saddam Hussein, but everybody's forgotten who financed Osama bin Laden and who financed Saddam Hussein from the 1980s, who gave him the chemical and biological weapons, who helped him use those chemical weapons against the Iranians, and, of course, who left him in power, not only in 1991, but in 1993 and 1995, according to Robert Byrd in his book, See No Evil. He was in charge of the CIA office in northern Iraq. Anyway, pick up the story from there.
Okay, I go back to Homeland Security and where we are right now. You were asking, what does our government really want? Well, I think what we're seeing through education, through the community groups, through President Bush's call to community service, and by putting Citizen Corps under Homeland Security, in other words, bringing people into various service learning groups, all of this has to do with creating solidarity in the communities. And we can remember Clinton talked about that quite a bit, that we have to be one, we have to live together with shared values and so on. So the idea is to mold beliefs and values in every part of our country, every segment of government, in every business, in homes, everywhere. This is part of what we have agreed to do through some of the treaties that have been ratified, but especially as we have endorsed what the United Nations, the whole education agenda, deals with creating world citizens to see ourselves as interconnected and can live together in peace in a multicultural, pluralistic society. And so the people who take a position on truth, who stand firm in Christ as Christians, who hold on to absolute truth, who even argue based on facts rather than the concept that we need to compromise in order to get along, we have to conform to the group in order to come to a consensus. We don't fit this new society of solidarity. President Clinton talked about it, Al Gore talked about it. In fact, he made an interesting statement. He said that he was speaking to a communitarian meeting in Washington, D.C. back in 1992, and he said, seeing ourselves as separate is a central problem in our political thinking. Let me read that again. Seeing ourselves as separate is a central problem in our political thinking. Well, I see myself as separate from many people. Not that I can't be friendly, that I don't want to help, take somebody by the hand and, encourage them if they're hurting, but as Christians, we are separate from an awful lot of other groups in this country within our belief system and our values. And, of course, that has to be dealt with. So I want to go back to what the key points in this transformation is the fact that we have a whole new interconnected governmental management system, total quality management, a global framework of networks and partnerships that supposedly operate by consensus, but having attended UN meetings and other meetings where you're supposed to have consensus, it's a very it's an illusion of consensus because they don't let people who wouldn't agree even say anything. Then the second part of this transformation is the mind-changing dialectic process, the facilitated group dialogue that would take place, again, in all the different segments of society, in the community service learning groups, in all kinds of service groups, the community forums, school board meetings, churches. Everybody's embracing this dialectic process. And what we have is the Hegelian dialectic, first used in Soviet Union to indoctrinate all the children and the adults with the Soviet ideology, and then to, where the group holds the people accountable forever afterwards, because now they're all learning to spy on one another. And we've talked before about the whole spy network and the call of the public. Now, I know that one of those spy programs, TIPS, were mail carriers and utility workers were to be asked to participate in spying on those that they are supposed, those that they are servicing. That was blocked by Congress back in December, and I'm very glad to, you know, that happened. But so many other things. I mean, once we see what their intention is and what they're trying to do, I'm not sure that something else isn't going to be replacing that particular system so that they can accomplish what they wanted to do in the first place. Wouldn't you agree, Dr. Steve?
Yes, I would certainly agree with that. So
now, I want to go back just to, again, well, then at the top of, we have a system and you have a process, and finally you have standards and assessments that hold everybody accountable. And we talked about that earlier. But now one of the organizations that would illustrate what we're talking about is the COPS program, the Community Policing Program. And I suggest that people come to our website and read the article by Philip Wirtz, who is a detective in San Diego, on the COPS program, because here we see much more clearly how this has worked out. And I'll give some documentation about what's part of it, because I have one of their facilitated training manuals, training for police facilitators for community groups, where they actually sit down and dialogue with the community, watch your community, and bring the community together. Let me just read one statement from that folder. It says, identifying common ground where all factions, here's what we are to do, and it lists various points, and one is identifying common ground where all factions of the community can work together for the common good of the community and in a broader problem-solving approach, forming a partnership between police and the rest of the community where each is accountable to each other and to the community as a whole.
And well, that really sounds very, very good. I mean, there's where is the objection to that, unless, of course, it is part of a much bigger plan that, of course, will allow, you know, everybody to begin thinking exactly the same and accepting the authoritarian rule of the police.
Right. It says it re-identifies the police role as a facilitator in the community. The facilitator is someone who leads the discussion toward a pre-planned outcome and teaches everyone the ground rules, and that is that you do not offend anybody by bringing up facts that would be disagreeable. You have to compromise. In other words, you have to move away from the position you originally stand or take and embrace a compromise position in your beliefs, values, and attitudes in order to get along with the group.
It just sounds exactly like the president's new No Child Left Behind program, which is not interested in the reading, writing, and arithmetic proficiency of our students, but in changing their attitude, values, and beliefs. And that's what it's all about. And so they want to do it not only with our children in the government schools, they want to do it with the adults in the community.
Right. Let me just read a list again in this particular manual on how to facilitate the group. It lists, they warn the police officers who will be facilitators that there might be somebody in the group who refuses to compromise their convictions or ignore the standard ground rules, you know, to respect all the members and don't argue or debate.
Don't argue and debate? Why to be there if you're not going to argue or debate?
Because you're supposed to dialogue, not debate. And dialogue is entirely different. It's where you listen to people. I mean, we want to listen, but you have to feel with them and understand their position, respect their position no matter how contrary it is to the biblical truth that guides our values and beliefs, and then be willing to compromise in your final decisions, again, for the sake of common good. But here is how they define those people who would be resistors. For example, blocking. That means arguing too much on the point, rejecting ideas without consideration. Of course, you are listening, but the idea is you reject an idea and you're unwilling to compromise and come to common ground. You're resisting. You're disagreeing and opposing beyond reason. Well, whose reason are we talking about? You know, bring up dead issues after they've been rejected or bypassed by the group. And that's an important point, because everything that the facilitator doesn't want to talk about, because it does present valid points that would lead toward the opposite perspective, that facilitator has been trained to set that aside, quickly move beyond it, ignore it, and then go on to the next point. But you see, you become a blocker if then you say, oh, we didn't finish that, or I didn't agree with that point.
In other words, basically what they want to do then is use the police as an extension of this, a means of controlling the reality, the minds, and the thoughts of the people. Now, that's a scary thing. That's the sort of thing you would do in an authoritarian society. And, of course, they don't want free and open debate. They want controlled debate. They want to give you about 2 or 3 minutes to present your position, not enough to really come up with anything valid. And then if you go against what the facilitator already knows what the outcome is going to be, doesn't he?
Right.
In other words, really, this is not to get your opinion. This is to get the group to accept the indoctrination, because all of these are indoctrination techniques. They're carefully devised by certainly people who have spent many years figuring out how to control the masses. And this is what they did in George Orwell's 1984, and this is what they're doing in our current society today. And are the police actually being trained as facilitators today?
Yes. I mean, this is what this is all about in states across the country.
But this is funded under
Homeland Security and the Justice Department.
Now, what we need to do is reach the police and let them understand what this is really all about. I would think that the police officers who are Christians are not going to fall into this trap, are they?
Well, we have... I hope not. And I have talked with some, Dr. Stan, and you probably have too, who see what's going on and are very concerned, very upset, to have lost their job because they're unwilling to compromise and conform, because the consensus groups are taking place even where they're not reaching out to the community. There is taking place within the police force, because everyone has to be trained in this process. But those who take a stand are having a real hard time. But we also know, just as there are Christian teachers who take a stand, there are other Christian teachers who conform, who don't see what's going on. They've been part of the process for so long. They enjoy the process, and they're unwilling to even consider that this is happening.
And of course,
you have both kinds.
These are the ones who preach Romans 13. And of course, the purpose of Romans 13 is to get the Christians to become part of the problem. In other words, don't object to anything. After all, didn't God put these people over you? You're simply to be obedient. In fact, if you object to what the government is doing, you are in disobedience to God.
Right.
And those are frightening things, especially when you realize this is exactly what they did in Hitler's Germany. And those of you who haven't read Erwin Lutzer's excellent book, Hitler's Cross, that's Hitler's Cross by Erwin Lutzer, need to get it and read it and understand they preach the gospel of Romans 13 in Hitler's Germany too. And if your minister is preaching Romans 13 to get you to be simply to sacrifice your principles and to give up what's right and wrong, you better give some serious thought about what they're doing and wonder who they serve rather than who you should serve, because we are all to serve our Lord. Not a minister who is preaching what I believe is the devil's own gospel.
And within this system, it will be forbidden to speak God's word, because that will be offensive. It doesn't fit the new pluralistic ideology. I want to bring up one other point, Dr. Stan, and that has to do with communitarianism, because I've been amazed at how similar, as I read the words from the White House website and from the Homeland Security, it sounds so much like the communitarian system.
Well, could you explain to our listeners what communitarianism is?
Well, I'd like to do that by again, quoting from Amitai Etzioni, who actually, is the founder of communitarianism. It's what Tony Blair talked about as a third way, and we know that Clinton referred to the third way. The third way is not capitalism, it's not communism, but it's something in between. But
why don't we call it corporate fascism?
Yeah, right. I think, well, he let me just read you a statement, because again, I've divided from a particular article which you can find. If you go to my Homeland Security article on our website, you will find a link to communitarianism several times actually. But here's the system. I'm quoting now from Amitai Etzioni's words. The good society is a partnership of three sectors, government, private sector, and community. While these may change, in a good society, the three sectors seek to cooperate with each other. So, and it talks about citizens, advisory boards, kind of a hierarchy of going all the way down to the social services at the community level. You have citizen participation advisory boards and so on. I know we don't have time to cover this in detail, but it sounds like a system, a hierarchical system, more like the Soviets in the Soviet Union, where everybody, again, operates in the consensus groups. And then the second part is the process, as I mentioned, the dialectic process. And here it says, third way governments. It links itself. This communitarianism is equated with third way. Third way governments do best when they resist the rush to legislate good behavior. Now, again, just that concept, of course, is intolerable to us as Americans, that the government should legislate how we are to. What they're really talking about is cooperative behavior. And it says, where there is a valid need to modify behavior, the state should realize that relying on informal community-based processes is preferable. And that's exactly what Bush is doing. He's using informal community-based processes through the various service organizations that he's calling people, all Americans, number of times on the White House website says all Americans must participate, all Americans have the responsibility, every person has to be part of the solution. Finally, it calls for the standards. It says to ensure. It says an annual assessment should be made. This is referring to schools, for example. It says the assessment should be made to make sure that all of the principles will be heeded. So what we have is the same three-pronged transformation that we see taking place in our government, and all of those, of course, fit into the new. To the vision of the United Nations for how the whole world should operate. So it's as if we're all conforming to a global agenda that tells us that we have to kind of all of us be molded, be squeezed into that new mold. And if you refuse to be squeezed into that mold, then of course you become a suspect.
Yeah, well, of course, I don't know whether President Bush is doing this. I think the people who control him are doing this. I think he's a figurehead for a power structure. I think that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice and the other people who come from the Council on Foreign Relations, I think they know exactly what this is all about and how much the president really understands, I don't know. But I will tell you, his administration is certainly pushing all of these things.
Right, and Dr. Stan, I agree with you. I want to stress that I can't tell you how glad I am that Al Gore is not president. And I know that President Bush has held there certain things that he can only do so much. And I do wonder how much he knows. But he's part of the system. Let me just read one other statement. So this actually fits right in with your book, In Brotherhood of Darkness, because I think what we see, it points out the problem that has been restricting presidents who didn't go along with this agenda for most of the century. But back in 1922, New York Mayor John Hyland said, that, he quotes, the real menace of our republic is this invisible government which, like a giant octopus, sprawls its length over city, state, and nation. It seizes in its long, powerful tentacles our executive offices, our legislative bodies, our schools, our courts, our newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection. And, of course, now that's happening on an international basis. But what we see, what it's telling us, is that the people who we see aren't the ones who necessarily are in the control.
You're absolutely right. The people who are in control are working within the shadows, and they control presidents. And if you don't believe that, we have a book written by Colonel House. It's called Philip II Administrator, telling how you control the president of the United States. It's a beautiful book telling how you declare a dictatorship in America, using the courts to accomplish it, and then, of course, how you control the president. Philip II Administrator, written in 1911, published 1912. You need to get it. You need to read it. You need to understand. It's all part of a grand plan. Barrett, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. Now,
can we
first of all get your website out, and then I want your parting thoughts.
Okay. Website is crossroad.to. That's the singular word, no S at the end of crossroads.to. T like in Tom, O like in Oscar. It stands for Tonga. Crossroad.to. And I hope you can come to our website, because I have a chart on brainwashing in America. We need to understand the strategies behind this process we discussed, what we can do to resist in our own minds, what we must teach our children, and the scriptures that will help them take a stand. Our children take a stand when they are put into the position where they're pressured to compromise by the group. I want to remind us that God has given us an armor. He tells us that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, authorities, the powers of this dark world, spiritual forces of evil in heavenly realms. Therefore, we must, in order to stand, we must wear his armor. We have a section on wearing the armor. Our children need to know that. And then finally, our God reigns. We don't have to be afraid. All of what's happening right now fits right into what the New Testament tells us would be happening in end times. And we can just praise him and delight in the God who has brought us into his kingdom, where he makes us more than conqueror.
Amen to that. Well, thank you so very much for being with us. Our guest has been Barrett Schoes. Again, our website is crossroad.to. Go there. Get her material. It's excellent, and we recommend it to you. God bless you, Barrett. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and, of course, we've been listening to Barrett Schoes, and, of course, talking about the Office of Homeland Security and the whole transformation of America, which is coming about because, of course, of the war on terrorism. And yet, of course, if you read all of this literature, has nothing to do with Islamic terrorism. It has everything to do with transforming the American society. And that's really what it was all about. Those of you who don't get my newsletter should. If you'd like a copy of my February newsletter, well, I simply point out that it was Zygmunt Brzezinski, one of the master architects of everything going on, who said, we're not going to be able to get a consensus in our multicultural society unless there is an event like a perceived direct external threat. Only with a perceived direct external threat are we going to be able to really change our attitude towards foreign policy. And then, of course, the remarks made by the people in the Rebuilding America's Defenses organization. Now, it all comes out of the Council on Foreign Relations. Certainly 12 of the 25 people in the Project for a New American Century that put out the Rebuilding America's Defenses report come from the CFR, which is a front for Cecil Rhodes Secret Society. And in that report, they talk about we're not going to be able to have a transformation of our military and begin moving towards our empire unless, of course, there's an event, a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor. That's their words, a catastrophic and catalytic event or catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor. So we're in real trouble as a nation. Everything is being engineered. Everything is being controlled. And there are only a few people out here who understand. We hope that you will understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield. And we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers. We ask you to pray for certainly a revival in America, because if the American people don't turn back to God, God's going to turn his back on America forever. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for our boys who will soon be going into battle, barring some of the miraculous thing that comes up. I feel the war is inevitable. I believe that we want to pray for the Israelis and the Arabs as well. Every one of them, an individual made uniquely in the image and likeness of God. And then please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Well, it's always a fast hour, 2 hours.
Yeah.
Hi, sweetie.
Hi.
Should I bring the box in?
Oh, no, Letitia will get it. Or is it all done?
Almost all.
Okay, well, we won't need them. Oh, no, I have to go over there and turn that off anyway.